Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, what kind of evidence do we have for the resurrection? After all, the Apostle Paul says, "And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins." Ken explains 20 strands of evidence on this podcast and others to follow, probably about four parts. So get ready to be equipped, right, Ken?
Yes, that's right. I don't think that there is really any more important discussion concerning apologetics than the resurrection of Jesus. And so, in a new manuscript that I've been working on, I've been stretching out those evidences and kind of bringing a few new ideas to what I've presented in the past in my books and articles. So I thought we could talk about 20 evidences or arguments or pieces of maybe spokes in the wheel supporting the resurrection.
Terrific. I'm sure you're going to answer this question, but I guess one of the things I have in mind right off the bat is, why is the resurrection so important?
Yeah. Well, that's a good place for us to begin, Joe. I think that the resurrection is clearly unique for a number of reasons, but let me mention one straight up. The bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ stands both as the faith's central doctrinal belief, as well as being the religion's primary evidence in terms of its truth claim. So the resurrection is different than many of the other doctrinal ideas. The resurrection is both something we have to believe in, because to be a Christian, you have to believe in Christ. You believe in his life, his death, his resurrection. So first of all, the resurrection is a doctrine. It is a belief that we must affirm. But at the same time that it's a doctrine that we must believe, it's also the very foundation for believing Christianity is true at all. And so it kind of functions, I think, distinctly in that way. And then there are other things I think that we could say about the resurrection. I mean, one of them certainly is that I think the Apostle Paul is quite clear that if the resurrection could be theoretically falsified, then our faith is vain, it's futile. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a very powerful point for a number of reasons. Certainly one of them is that, as I've studied many of the religions of the world, I'm not always sure what would potentially falsify some of these religions. So to have the great advocate of Christianity, Paul the Apostle, who at one time, of course, didn't believe it, and in fact, his conversion will be one of those pieces of evidence, if you will. But, you know, here you have Paul stating, look, if this didn't actually happen in time and space, if it didn't really happen in the real world, then, let Christianity go and affirm something else. Maybe you'd want to go back to traditional Judaism, or maybe you want to adopt skepticism. So the resurrection is definitely a distinctive truth in Christianity. And again, functioning as one of the major beliefs, but also functioning as evidence for the truth of that. So I think that kind of sets us up to talk a little bit about some of these pieces of evidence. And I want to begin, Joe, with the first one.
I have a comment before you move on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just struck when you made the comment that as a Christian, I have to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I understand what you mean when you say that. It's a truth claim.
Yeah.
But the thing that came to mind was that not only do we have to believe it, we get to believe it.
Yeah.
You understand the distinction I'm making here?
Yeah,
I
do.
It's a privilege that we get to believe in something that is true and something that is life-changing.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful truth. And I was struck, I think it's Lewis that makes the point that if Christianity is not true, it's not worth the paper it's written on. But if it's true, it's the most important truth than we can possibly imagine.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it is the hope. And of course, I like to contrast that with the worldview of naturalism. I like to talk in terms of who has the last say in your worldview. And I often like to say that in naturalism, entropy has the last word. But in Christianity, Jesus Christ has the last word. And so, no, I take your point very seriously, Dave. I think that the resurrection is our hope. It is, if Christ didn't raise, now here I'll quote Yaroslav Pelikan. Pelikan would say, if Christ is risen, nothing else matters. And if Christ has not, nothing else matters. That's kind of an interesting and enigmatic statement. But I think what Pelikan was really getting at is the best evidence of immortality, of life after death, that there is something beyond the grave, is found in Jesus Christ. And if it's not worth it, then we're... maybe there is no ultimate meaning and purpose to life. And so absolutely, this is our hope. It is our deepest conviction. And I agree with you, Dave. I don't think, we talk a lot at Reasons to Believe about both apologetics and evangelism. And we try to help people to feel confident in their faith so that they can talk with people about the truths of Christianity. But I think you're right, Dave. I think that the most important thing, if Jesus actually rose from the dead bodily, if he were crucified publicly under Pontius Pilate, executed, buried, that is, put into a tomb, and then 3 days later he rose from the dead, if that actually happened, then I don't think there's any more important information in the world to have than that very thing. And, you know, that motivates me. I like to be very deliberate and careful about how I share my faith. I don't talk about my faith to everybody at all times. I try to pick my situations because, quite frankly, I'm trying to see what the best opportunity is to share my faith. But, you know, it often motivates me to say, hey, look, if Christ is risen from the dead, this is something you need to tell people about. Mm-hmm. And so, that's a great point, Dave. It is our hope. And of course, as the older we get, the more we realize, if transhumanism doesn't work out, then there's no hope apart from the resurrection. Well, let's get into the five that we are going to discuss in this program. The first piece of evidence for the resurrection, I think clearly, is Jesus's burial tomb was empty. And so, you know, the Gospels are themselves what we would call ancient biographies. They're the equivalent of an ancient biography. And right at the core of these biographies, when it turns to Jesus's death, is that Jesus's burial tomb on Sunday morning was empty. It was found empty by his apostles. Prior to that, there were women at the tomb who had some encounter with apparently an angel, who pronounced that Jesus had been raised, that he was not in his tomb. And, you know, what's interesting, guys, is when you look at the higher critical theories, you know, you think about the Jesus Seminar. This is a group of biblical scholars, ancient historians, who look at the evidence for the life of Jesus, for his death and resurrection. And of course, a good number of these people are quite critical of the resurrection. not necessarily on the basis of evidence. Now, I'll come back to that and I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit later. But a lot of these people who are skeptical, they agree that the empty tomb may be one of the strongest evidences, and therefore we can be quite confident that the tomb was empty. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, by saying that, why is that the case? Well, a number of things can be said. You know, this comes from a very early report. There's no reason to think that the facts relating to the empty tomb have been embellished. We know who owned the tomb. The New Testament Gospels mention Joseph of Arimathea. None of the people connected with it are thought to be mythological. And so I'd like our listeners to appreciate that here you have this group of scholars, call them the Jesus Seminar, right? Go back a couple decades, develop this kind of liberal theological think tank. And they say that one of the best assured evidences is that on Sunday morning, Jesus's tomb was empty. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that then, if the tomb were not empty, game's over,
yeah.
Right? If you can discover the body, that's it. But the very reason that the Jewish religious leaders who were rather hostile to Jesus became interested in this, and the reason that later the Romans were informed about this was that there had been this Nazarene preacher, this Galilean, who had had a life of doing miracles, making claims that he had the prerogatives of deity. He claimed to forgive people's sin. He claimed that he could hear and answer prayer. He even predicted that he would raise himself from the dead. Well, the reason all of this kind of comes to the forefront is they know where Jesus's tomb was. You know, and again, in the backdrop of all of this is it possible we could explain the so-called resurrection of Jesus by purely natural means? And that is, you know, maybe the disciples went to the wrong tomb. Well, I would say, and I'm going to say later in our series of programs, that one of the best evidences that Jesus did rise from the dead is because all of the alternative naturalistic theories prove futile and false. I mean, it was Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. The Romans and the Jews, they knew about Jesus and they knew where his burial tomb was. The idea that they went to a, you know, an alternative tomb, it doesn't work. And by the way, the Jews and the Romans had enough staff that they could have found the tomb no matter where it was. So this is a very early source.
I have a question.
Yeah,
regarding, sure. You just used that term, early source. I would like you to make a comment on historical evidence. I could see somebody might be saying, you know what, I can't believe anything I can't see and test right now today. It kind of seems to me that very little evidence is current. Most evidence is historical. Now, I wonder if you might make a comment about the reliability of historical evidence.
Yeah, I think in light of the empty tomb, what we can say is that when we look at the four Gospels, it is true that when those Gospels were written, unlike the Pauline epistles, there's no name of the author attached to them. So they're anonymous. And of course, this kind of gets people a little nervous, or, you know, who in the heck wrote these if we don't know? Well, all it simply means is that the Apostle Paul had the habit of, you know, signing his name. But in terms of the early church, you know, some of the early church fathers, Irenaeus, Papias, others, they said, they gave us the names of the authors of these four gospels. So let me talk a little bit about that in terms of kind of historical history. You know, here you have four authors. You have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And that's kind of peculiar. Matthew and Mark, they're not one of the original 12 apostles. Why would Matthew and Mark be writing the Gospels? Now, excuse me, Matthew would have a connection to the 12. But Mark? Who's Mark? Then who's Luke? Luke, of course, we know later is an associate of the Apostle Paul. Then we have John, and the traditional definition is that it was John the Apostle. But, you know, if all of this was made up, if this was just a story, I doubt that Mark and Luke would have been included because they don't have any standing. Now here's the backdrop of all of this. Here's what the early church fathers, and by the way, I have to bring this up. You know, Protestants at times, and I'm a Protestant, so I can speak to this. I think at times, in order to argue for the unique authority of Scripture, we kind of downplay tradition. Probably it's in the context of our inner Christendom debates between Catholics and Protestants that takes place. But my point here is simply to make this. Church tradition is very, very valuable. And it kind of exists alongside of the Scriptures. And in this kind of context, it's reading the early church fathers that we discover who these authors were. Now, let me mention just a couple things about them. Why would Mark's gospel play such an important role? I mean, you have what we call the syntopical problem. You have three of the gospels seem to be very similar in the way they lay out the events: Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in fact, Matthew and Luke, there's a good part of the two of those gospels that is almost identical to what you find in Mark. So the syntopical problem: why are these three gospels so similar? Why is John so different? Well, let me lay out a conservative Christian scenario. Because Mark was the Emmanuelus of Peter. The early church fathers recognized that Peter had some talking points. And if you go to the book of Acts, which is kind of the early story of the Christian church, Peter is the principal spokesperson. You don't have to accept him as the Pope, but he is initially kind of the man on the spot. And it's thought that Mark is merely representing the writings of Peter, that Mark took these talking points, right? You know, if I were involved in politics, and let's say I worked for the president, I might go on a talk show on Sunday morning and I've got my talking points here. I want to cover this material. I want to make my case. I want to present my viewpoint. Well, the early church fathers recognized that Peter is the original author of the Gospel of Mark, and that Mark is his Emmanuelus. Now, if that is in fact the case, and that's held very strongly by most conservative Christians, then you can see why Matthew and Luke would use that as a source, because it's very early. It goes back to Peter, after all. Peter is not just one of the 12, he's one of the inner circle. And then if you introduce Luke, and Luke has what connections to the Apostle Paul, now we're back to the inner circle, right? We're back to
apostolic authority.
we're back to the very center of apostolic authority itself. And so when we talk about that early source, this goes back to the very people that saw the tomb empty, Peter, John. And you know, we could talk a lot more about that, Joe. I mean, I'll say something about this a little bit later in one of the evidence that I present. But in terms of comparing Christianity to other religions or to other historical things, the New Testament is it's endowed with great resources. I mean, we've got early copies of the Gospels and of Paul's epistles that go back very, very early. And so it's true. I mean, somebody can say, I don't believe anything I don't see. Of course, you didn't see that thought in your mind. You don't see electrons. By the way, there's this COVID-19 virus that you can't see. So you got to be careful about making statements about things you can't see. There are a lot of things we can't see. But, you know, I was born after D-Day, but there's enormous testimony that D-Day took place 14 years before I was born.
You know, so this COVID-19 thing, I can't help but make the comment that here is this little few lengths of RNA, like you say, you can't even see it. But it brought the whole world to its knees.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the reality is that in philosophy and in science, there are lots of things we cannot observe. You can't see numbers. You can't see the laws of logic. And so you kind of have to break people out of that kind of, how would I call it? Kind of a crude empiricism, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now let me move to...
I'm sorry.
Jump in.
I like how you answered that question about historical evidence, because I could see somebody not wanting to bother with the historical evidence, but you, at least in my mind, have made it clear, like, if there's an objection to the authorship, you've made that connection there to the apostles that one can find if they dig into it. But it seems like those apostles didn't care to, because at that time it's like, well, everybody knows, you know, that this is the account, here it is, we'll leave it to whoever else later on to sort those things out.
You know, that's a very important point. And again, I want our listeners to appreciate it. The point here is, if the apostles, you know, and this is kind of a strange idea, but if the apostles wanted to make the resurrection accounts the prettiest, if they wanted to decorate them and make them ultimately persuasive, why would we have four Gospels and two are written by people that are not the original apostles at all? I think that this is actually evidence that it's that way because it's true, not because anybody colored it up. And that's another reason I think when I read through the New Testament, there are a lot of times where the apostles, they look weak, they look rather lame, they do a lot of things that I think, boy, you know, this is a pretty rough and ready group of people. But that first piece of evidence that the tomb is empty, that needs an explanation. And once you start going down the side of naturalistic explanations, they don't pan out well.
Yeah. You know, I like your point about not embellishing the story, because a lot of times when you read something about some historical event and it kind of smells of conspiratorial thinking, it seems way over the top. But in this case, these are not over the top.
Yeah. Now the second one, I think the second piece of evidence here, I think really opens up something very interesting. And the second piece of evidence for the resurrection that I'm going to appeal to is that Jesus appeared alive after his public death. Jesus appeared alive after his public death. So I quite frankly don't know any death in history that has the gravitas, the magnitude of the death of Jesus Christ. I think if you were to, you know, have a quiz show and ask anybody, who was the Roman guy that had authority to put Jesus to death? I mean, Pontius Pilate, in an age in which washing your hands is very important in light of the COVID-19, he washed his hands of Jesus. And that expression, I've washed my hands of you. Well, Jesus's death was a public death. And what's really interesting here is that N.T. Wright, and I'm going to give you the quote I'll give you a detailed quote here in a few minutes. One of the points that N.T. Wright makes is that very few people at all ever question the death of Jesus. So let me now give you a quotation from a liberal scholar. This is John A.T. Robinson of Cambridge University. He says that the burial in the tomb is, quote, one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. So John A.T. Robinson is not a conservative Christian scholar. He was a more liberal scholar. And he says the burial tomb of Jesus is, quote, one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. Now, let me then bring in alongside that this second piece of evidence that Jesus appeared alive after his public death. Now, what I hope pops into your mind at this point is, if this didn't happen, if Jesus didn't actually rise from the dead, then we need two naturalistic explanations. We need an explanation of why the tomb was empty, and now we need another explanation about who are these people seeing? How do you explain both the empty tomb, and now you need another explanation, namely that the early disciples of Jesus claimed that they had personal encounters. They saw him, they heard him, they touched him. And what's interesting about this is if you go again back to the theologically liberal, the highly skeptical think tank, call it the Jesus Seminar, higher critical scholars, I would say a majority of them believe that the apostles really were convinced that they had seen Jesus risen from the dead. Now, I'll spill the beans, of course, and say that these scholars often will say, look, I don't believe in the miraculous. I'm a naturalist. My worldview tells me miracles don't happen. But when they look at the evidence of the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances, they say, no, I really don't think the disciples were inventing this. They weren't lying. They weren't making it up. They were really convinced that they had seen and observed Jesus alive after he had been executed. Now, what are we to make of that? Well, one of the things I would tell you is you have to test your worldview. Worldviews are often adopted. I basically got my worldview from my parents. You know, you might love your parents, or you might, you know, be uncomfortable with your parents, but your parents often are the ones who give you your basic view of the way the world really is. But you have to test your worldview. Who is to say that miracles are not possible? I mean, after all, people who believe in the traditional Big Bang theory believe that all matter, energy, space, and time had a singular beginning from nothing. That sounds kind of miraculous to me, but essentially within this skeptical group of scholars, they don't dispute some of these early pieces of evidence. They simply fall back on the idea that, look, my worldview has no place for the miraculous, but I can't dispute the evidence that you're giving about a miraculous event. And so, so part of the skepticism, part of the lack of belief is not a lack of evidence, but worldview presuppositions. And I think you have to be very critical of your presuppositions. I think you have to be rigorous in analyzing them. Now, let me develop just a couple ideas about these appearances. You know, they claim to have seen Jesus, heard him. Some of them claim to have touched him. The appearances don't appear to be spiritual or ghost-like. This is not a Gnostic experience, right? The resurrection appearances are diverse and they're varied. That is, Jesus appears to men and women. The appearance of women is really rather unusual, given that at the time, and you can certainly, within the context of the time in which we live, say, wow, people were kind of prejudicial. They were, when it comes to gender and sex, this was kind of a period that was male-dominated. But the idea here was that a woman's testimony in court was not on the level with a man. And so if the apostles made this up, if this was a story, if this was merely mythological, I doubt whether they would have the first people bumping into Jesus being women. And yet that's this embarrassing story, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So to men and women, he appears to friends and enemies. We'll have more to say about the enemies later. Sometimes it's individuals, sometimes it's large groups. It's to people on single occasions. Sometimes he appears to people on more than one occasion, during the day, during the night, indoors, outside. It's very difficult to come up with a explanatory theory as to how all that would work out. It's difficult to say they had a hallucination.
Because you have too many appearances. Right?
Too many diverse experiences. And you even have people who were unbelievers. They had no expectation of this. I mean, here I'm speaking of Jesus's half-brother James or Saul of Tarsus. They had no expectation that this would happen. You know, to have some kind of hallucination, you have to light the match, so to speak. So here we have this, you know, kind of the second rung in all of this. And let me give you this quote by N.T. Wright. He says that the reports of both Jesus's empty tomb and his after-death appearances to his followers have a, quote, historical probability so high as to be virtually certain, like the death of Augustus in AD 14 or the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And that's a very powerful statement. I've read N.T. Wright's very large volume on the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, it is a major work. And I remember Wright saying that when he finished it, he sent it to one of his mentors at university. I think it was at Oxford. And his mentor said to him, I can't dispute your arguments. All I can tell you is my worldview won't allow me to believe in the supernatural. So now we get into, I think, things that are really very important when it comes to apologetics, when it comes to evangelism. Is the problem of the resurrection, is it a problem of evidence? That is there a lack of evidence, or is it a problem of presuppositions? And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of apologetic methodology. You know, are you a classical apologist? Are you an evidentialist? Are you a presuppositionalist or new reformed epistemology or a cumulative case? You know, you can go to the book Five Views of Apologetics and you have five people kind of making their case. I tend to think that there's a lot of common ground. I'd rather talk to a non-Christian than debate with Christians about whether I'm presenting the gospel properly or not. But having said all of that, I think a point that is made among presuppositional apologists is that everybody comes to the table with preconditions, with presuppositions. And so the problem may not be arguments. The problem may not be evidence. The problem may be the worldview assumptions you bring to the table. And I think that's an utterly, I mean, here I have quoted A.T. Robinson, that the empty tomb is one of the best evidences. And now from N.T. Wright, who is a world famous New Testament scholar, historian of ancient Christianity, and he says the idea of the empty tomb and the appearances of Jesus have the historical probability so high to be compared with undisputably questionable things like the death of Caesar Augustus or Jerusalem's fall in 70 AD. I mean, that's a pretty powerful thing. Could I say, by the way, that that I think one of the reasons that people would like to say Jesus is a myth, that Jesus never existed, and again, you'll have to consider the claims they make and what I think are the counter evidence to that, but I think the reality is that if you take the New Testament seriously, you're gonna have to look at the weight of the evidence. And if you could kind of dismiss it, whether ever getting into it at all, I can see why somebody would prefer to go in that direction. But of course, if Jesus didn't exist, then did Caesar Augustus exist? Did Plato and Aristotle exist? I mean, what happens to the university if you adopt the Christ myth idea? I think the humanities and classical literature become doubtful. And most scholars don't accept that. So here we start off with two solid pieces of evidence that the tomb was empty. And however you account for the apostles claiming that they saw Jesus from the dead, even some of the higher critical scholars say they actually believed it. The idea that they were hallucinating just doesn't hold any water. Now, what would be an alternative theory? Well, some higher critical scholars might say that maybe the apostles had what we might call religious visions. So they had some kind of religious experience, but not necessarily veridical in time and space experience. Now, I don't know how you sort all of that out. I mean, I don't know how you have religious experience if religion is false. I don't know how you have, I don't know how that saves you from this, but I'm trying to at least give you the thoughts behind some of the critical scholars. Hmm. Well, let me move to number three, the third link in the chain. Jesus's resurrection was a predicted and expected event. Now, one of the points I want to make there is, you know, there are weird things that happen in life. I know this because I've written about some weird things in life. I'm one of the RTB guys that wrote that book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. And I've looked into UFOs, and I'm telling you, that's a weird world. You know, I also wrote a book about claimed Marian apparitions. And I've even gone to Europe and talked with the visionaries, and so I have entered into the world of unusual types of experiences, and all of the listeners know I'm a JFK assassination buff. I mean, talk about controversial ideas. Well, what I want to say here is that the resurrection of Jesus is not one of those weird out of left field, inexplicable thing, because if you read through the Gospels, Jesus himself on numerous occasions says, I am going to be killed. I'm going to be put to death, but on the third day, I will rise from the dead. I mean, Jesus repeats this. It's in Matthew 16. It's in Mark 8. It's in Luke 9. It's in John 2, John 10. That is what we have here is we have an occasion where Jesus actually predicts this is going to be the case. And of course, if he didn't rise from the dead, then immediately he'd be seen as a false prophet. So there is a context to give this. Jesus is the very one himself who says that he is going to be killed, but on the third day he is going to rise from the dead. So, I mean, if Jesus were a false prophet, or if Jesus were just well-intended, maybe he thought he was the Messiah, but he really wasn't, you know, was he like David Koresh, a maniacal person? Was he a Jim Jones, or was he just kind of, you know, somebody who thought God was speaking to him? Was he mentally ill? Was he bipolar? I mean, the reason I mention these issues is, how do you explain the data? But here you have Jesus, who would go on to be the most influential person in the history of the world. I mean, think about it. There's the world before Jesus, and there's the world after him. And that's the way the calendar is. Jesus is the most influential person in the world. I don't think anybody comes close. The second place is distant. But if that's the case, how did this person change the world? Why is he a person of such renown? Is your naturalistic explanation going to say, well, he never actually existed at all? Or is your explanation going to be that he was mentally ill, or that he lied about all of this? I mean, you have these multiple explanatory theories. How do you explain the resurrection? But then how do you explain Jesus? Now, again, I'm not big on apologetic methodology, because I'd rather talk to people about the faith than debate other Christians about whether I'm doing it right or not. But again, I would say, from my own vantage point, that there's a cumulative case going on here. And so the context of the resurrection is to be found in the ministry of Jesus. I mean, after all, this was a person who was claiming to do miracles. This was a person who had a deep sense of the presence of God. He claimed to have the prerogatives of deity. He was turning the world upside down. So there's a context to this strange and unusual, his body's missing after death. Now people say they're seeing him, but this is the very same person who made these claims and was a person who had worked miracles. So we're starting to put these together, right? This isn't just anybody. This is that man from Nazareth. This is the Galilean. This is the person who has healed lepers. This is the person who is like unto the great Old Testament prophets. Mm-hmm. So we start to see that.
Yeah. Who else would say, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up again? What mere human is going to come out and say, kill me and I'll raise myself up 3 days later?
That's right. And I think you have to deal with Jesus. You know, C.S. Lewis kind of popularized the idea of Josh McDowell later kind of took it as the Lord Liar Lunatic. Lewis, of course, considered the idea of legend, and he said, look, I know about legends and myths. I've been reading them my whole life. I can tell you what I read in the New Testament is not myth or legend. what I do is I take Lewis and I developed what I call the M hypothesis. Is he man, myth, madman, menace, mystic, Martian, or Messiah? I mean, give me your M. and I'm willing to sort it through. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have to consider Martian because there are people today who think, you know, just watch the History Channel. There are people who think space visitors have come down. But I think if you grant any of those explanations, what you end up with is there really is good reason to think that God had visited this planet in the person of Jesus Christ. As extraordinary as the incarnation is, it actually makes sense to think that it happened.
My experience with people who are somewhat educated and are non-Christian, atheist, is that they will dismiss it all as a record that's not reliable.
Yeah.
You know, something that you addressed a few minutes ago. But that's kind of, they haven't really investigated it thoroughly, but they've taken the word of some of these more popular writers who will do that. They'll just dismiss it all as we can't trust it as a historical document.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up right at this very point because that leads us into point four. But I want to say prior to that, Dave, that, you know, when you look at if you look at the Jesus Seminar and you look at some of a person like N.T. Wright, these higher critical scholars, they don't have answers to people like N.T. Wright. They make a very, very powerful case. And so let's take on four in light of Dave's comment. The fourth strand, piece of evidence, an argument, if you will, a brief time period between the actual events and the eyewitness claims. Now, what does that mean? What is a brief time period between the actual events and the eyewitness claims? Well, look, if, you know, the longer time period you would have between when these events were to have actually happened and when the eyewitnesses encounter, then the more reason to be suspect because, you know, over time, maybe myth and legend could have crept in there and, you know, maybe all kinds of things could have happened. But what's interesting here is that I actually take a little bit of a different argument here. What New Testament scholars have discovered, and this has probably been over the last 50 years or so, New Testament scholars have discovered that there are creedal statements, and in one occasion, even an ancient hymn that seemed to be weaved into particularly Paul and Peter's writings. And what these scholars have concluded is that Paul and Peter, who were, of course, two of the original kind of the inner circle, the Peter, James, and John experienced the resurrected Jesus. Later, Paul was brought into this through his own experience of the resurrected Christ. But you have an early church, and I want to call it primitive church. And I don't mean primitive in a critical way. I mean primitive in the sense that this was a completely Jewish church. This is before any of the Gentiles came along. If I said early church, you might think, well, you know, what, when they had the Nicene Council? No, I mean primitive. This is before apparently any of the Gentiles had come in. Now, the point here is that when you look at the writings, I mean, how are we to date the Gospels? Well, you know, it kind of depends on whether you accept a more liberal interpretation or a conservative interpretation, but maybe Mark is written in the 50s. Maybe Matthew and Luke are maybe written in the 60s, maybe John a little bit later in 70 AD. Of course, if you're more liberal and critical, you might back those up another decade or so. But what's interesting here is that these creedal statements, and Philippians 2 has a hymn, these are statements that scholars now believe were actually repeated into the early church. These were creeds that the early Christians would recite. And one of them actually appears, in 1 Corinthians 15. And in fact, this is the statement where it says that Christ died, he was buried, he was raised, he appeared. Biblical scholars now believe that that was actually a creedal statement. And even though it appears in 1 Corinthians, which was probably written in the 50s, the actual creed itself goes back to the very earliest point of Christianity. And what's of further interest there is that these creedal statements, they have a very high Christology. I mean, in Philippians 2, it says that, you know, Jesus left his state of heaven, but didn't hold on to it. He didn't insist on that being the case, but he became a bondservant. And these passages actually reference a high Christology. They refer to Jesus as God. So you also have to pack into this that the people writing about this, that is Peter through the Gospel of Mark and his epistles, Paul and his epistles, what we actually have are statements about the resurrection that go very close to the actual events themselves. Now, let me give you a context here. Let me pick Buddhism. Siddhartha Gautama, who is the Buddha, he's similar to Jesus in certain ways. He has disciples. He has followers. And his followers write down things he said. So you could, just as you have Jesus studies, you could have Buddha studies. But here's the interesting thing. Buddha scholars don't know what century the Buddha was born in. That is, the writings from his followers are hundreds of years later. And they don't know what century to put him in. I could mention Krishna studies. There are Hindu scholars that they don't even know if Krishna existed at all. So you need a little perspective. I mean, when we debate questions like what year was Jesus born? Well, most scholars think 6 to 4 BC. What year did he die? 30 AD, maybe 33. And people get excited and say, when you don't have all this nailed down, well, you need a little perspective. We know an incredible amount about Jesus when you compare it to other people in the ancient world, like Buddha. So you have a close connection here when it comes to a very brief time period between when these events happened and when you have a witness to people who claim to have seen it. So you have Peter, you have Paul, not only writing books at a very early date, but actually referencing material that goes back even further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
Now, number five, and again, we'll try to, I'm trying to, you know, when you talk about 20 evidences, I don't want to talk about them all in one show and not have time to develop them. So Joe, I'm gonna make this my last point for this program anyway, and it's a broad statement, but I want to develop it. Number five, the astonishing change in the apostles' lives. The astonishing change in the apostles' lives. You know, let's go back to the Gospels when Jesus is arrested, and when he is taken into arrest by the Jewish religious leaders and later executed by the Romans, the apostles are very fearful. You know, I'll tell you, if these are Jesus's friends that he's counting on to be supportive of him, you know, they don't seem very courageous. They seem to be very afraid. And yet something happens. They claim it's the resurrection. And I think clearly the mindset is these people have seen the resurrected Jesus and they say, well, what could hurt us now? I mean, if our Lord and Savior has conquered death, what are the Jews and the Romans going to do to us? And you see it, you see an extraordinary change in the apostles. They go from being cowards to some of them become martyrs. In fact, the most important of them do. By the way, I should say that there is within scholarship debate about how much persecution Christians really experienced. There are some scholars who think that maybe Christians have exaggerated the persecution they received. And I'm talking within multiple centuries. So not all of the 12 apostles died martyrs' deaths. But I can tell you with confidence that Peter did, that Paul did, that James did. Now we're talking about three quarters of the inner circle. I mean, typically the inner circle is Peter, James, John, and Paul. Three of them, Peter and Paul. I don't think there really is any serious doubt whatsoever that Peter and Paul were executed in the Neronian persecution right around 62-64 AD. And there is good evidence that James, and there are multiple James, so we need to identify who we're talking about. This is James, the brother of Jesus. And I'm going to have more to say about him in a little while in the next program. But there is a dramatic change in the apostles. And I can mention if I can here a little bit. Let me just say a couple things about two of them. One of the things that I have discovered from skeptics is they think religious people are easy marks. That is, they think that religious people don't critically analyze things. They think that religious people believe things too quickly. They're credulous, right? Well, I actually think when it comes to two of the apostles, that it runs against that. Let's talk about Thomas and James. Thomas is one of the original 12, and apparently he didn't see the early appearance of Jesus, and he questions his disciples. He questions his brothers, and he insists, "Look, I'm not going to believe it unless I see the nail marks in his hand, unless I can reach my hand and put it into his side. I'm not willing to believe it." And yet, he becomes a full supporter of the resurrection because he saw the resurrected Christ. He seems very skeptical. I think it's even more the case with James, the brother of Jesus. I mean, think about it for a minute. Think about it for a minute. If you go back to the Gospels, you see pretty early that the family of Jesus, they're perplexed by Jesus. Even Jesus's mother, Mary. There are statements in the Gospels where the family thinks they have to do an intervention. Mm. That, you know, Jesus has gone off the rails. He's going around making himself appear to be the Messiah. Well, James and his family, they think he's lost it. Now, I mean, think about it. You're talking about first century Judaism. You're talking about monotheism, for somebody to claim to be God. Can you imagine what James must have thought? Did he think his brother was mentally ill? And yet, something happens. James, we're told that James saw the resurrected Christ. So I think that fifth point is a very important one, and that is that you not only have a dramatic change, but you have a dramatic change in two of them that are dead set against all of this. I mean, Thomas really is a doubter. He really is questioning. And I think James's testimony may be the most convincing. I mean, can you imagine the embarrassment he had? What would have had to happen for him to change from thinking his brother was emotionally ill or mentally ill to becoming one of the leaders in the Jerusalem Council in the book of Acts?
Yeah.
I mean, we all have strange family members. I won't ask you to mention any. I won't mention any in my family. You know, we all have the kind of the weird uncle. You know, he's kind of, I don't know, you know, he exaggerates. He, you know, he's not the truth teller. Or, you know, we know people in our family. And here James is now willing to lay his life down. So I think those five pieces of evidence, they are very convicting. I think they're worthy of our serious evaluation, that the tomb is empty, that there are appearances of the resurrected Christ, that, you know, these things happen very, very soon. They're reported very soon after they happened. And there is a dramatic change in the apostles. And, you know, these are things that I don't think you can easily, you know, and then if you again consider the context that Jesus made predictions, he said this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are our five. We got 15 more, but
is that all?
That's.
I want 21, and I'll be convinced.
That'll be my next book, Joe. All I could come up with is 20.
Well, thank you for expressing these five. I've found them helpful, and hopefully our listeners have as well. One of the things I like about straight thinking is that you're talking this through with Dave and I, and I'm sure it's the same for you, Dave. You're picking things up that you can use to talk to other people about.
Right, right.
And then, of course, you're going to recommend resources, and you already have. But it's like, oh, cool, now I can read stuff too. But it's just kind of talking it through like this and hearing your thoughts. It's like, okay, I can go out and talk to, you know, this neighbor of mine, coworker, whoever it is, family member. So it's very helpful. Thank you for that.
I think the thing is,
resource or two right now, you want to wait till the next.
Well, I think it would be good to maybe give some sources. I mean, okay. I mean, if you're very interested in a very serious discussion of the resurrection, then you want to go to people like N.T. Wright. He has a series of books that he's written, The Resurrection of Jesus, the Son of God. There are other really good books. I'm happy to say that Gary Habermas is a leading scholar on the resurrection, and I'm very pleased to say that I know Gary. Gary is a friend. He's endorsed a couple of my own books. I would look at some of what Habermas has written, some of the books that he has done. And I've written on this topic. Again, these 20 evidences will go in the new manuscript that I'm working on. But in my book, Seven Truths That Changed the World, and in Without a Doubt, I address some of this material.
Excellent. The thing that's always struck me when talking to people is that if a person doesn't have an interest in investigating this stuff, they're going to just dismiss it based on, you know, rather weak arguments that have been put forth. And I, you know, that's what I find. I find that too many people are just indifferent, that they aren't willing to to really investigate and say, is this true or is it not true? But for the person who really cares and really wants to know the truth, there's tremendous resources available.
And I think, Dave, that's a very astute point.
I'm a pretty astute guy.
And you didn't just fall off the watermelon truck the other day. You have a PhD in physics, by the way. But the point you have led me to want to convey is this. Please don't mistake that these five evidences in a vacuum are going to convince people. If you read the New Testament, you're going to discover that people have a heart problem. And the Holy Spirit has to be involved. I think the only way somebody can really genuinely become interested in pursuing God is if God does a work in that person's life. Now, that takes us off into all kinds of provocative theological topics.
Right.
What does the Holy Spirit do? Does he woo us, or does he actually do heart surgery on us? Why doesn't he do it to everybody? I mean, that opens up all kinds of theological doors that at one time or another, we've knocked on those doors here on Straight Thinking. Yeah. But Dave, your point is such an important one. And I don't think we should be doing apologetics or doing evangelism without the deep recognition of a reliance upon the Holy Spirit for the Spirit to open someone's heart. So I definitely don't think that arguments in and of themselves, apart from the Spirit, can bring a person to the point of faith. So thank you, Dave. That's an important point.
All right. Well, thank you, Ken, for your thoughts. We'll pick it up on the next one and learn about five more strands of evidence for the resurrection of Christ. Be sure to share the link and tell people about the podcast and tune in next time. Listen to this podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. That could be Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or Spotify. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.